Nathaniel Raymond was 18 years old when he did his first stint as an aid worker. By the time he was 30, he'd been to just about every humanitarian disaster zone around the world, bringing help to people in areas hit by war and floods, hurricanes, earthquakes, disease, drought, and famine. At one point, he realized that he was carrying a lot of it with him wherever he went.
And you're bringing this herd of elephants into the room with you, and people in everyday life get to a point where, okay, great, sorry about the starving children in Africa, but could you be here now and listen to me about how I got stuck in traffic and missed my first appointment this morning? Huh. And that's really important to me, and I'm sorry about all the death and suffering, but can you hear me now?
Nathaniel Raymond discovered something on his own, that even after years in disaster zones, it's hard for an aid worker to ask for help. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
At this one moment, there are thousands of humanitarian aid workers at disaster sites around the world. It just happens that the two most recent are the towns and cities hit by the earthquake in China and all the people still at risk after the cyclone in Burma.
It's very difficult work. It's extremely hot right now. And all the evaporating flood water is making things much worse for the workers because
it's been absolutely pouring down with rain for the last 3 or 4 hours, and we could actually even be facing floods. So it's a very dire situation indeed.
For more than a decade, these places were home to Nathaniel Raymond. He's been through the Middle East and across Africa and Asia with Oxfam and Physicians for Human Rights. His busiest year, and the one that finally led him to question how much he could handle, was the year 2005.
Good evening. More than 11,000 people are now thought to have been killed in southern Asia after an undersea earthquake sent enormous waves rolling across the Indian Ocean. Waves up to 10 meters high engulfed the coasts of many countries.
I was there right at the beginning, and it was a lot to take. The pace during those opening days of an emergency is extremely grueling. It's the most grueling experience of my life. You know, you just work almost literally around the clock till you drop.
Where were you sent when you got word of the tsunami? What happened with you?
Soon after New Year's, I was put on a plane for Colombo with the Oxfam International Response. And so it was right off the plane. I remember it looked like nothing was happening, you know, because we weren't near the coast yet. But what was amazing is already just coming from the airport, there was traffic problems because of the processions carrying dead to be burned. And then within a couple days or so, I was out on the east coast of Sri Lanka in a place called Batticaloa, and it was like an atomic bomb had gone off. You'll be driving through a community that looks normal, and then suddenly there's just like this line, and everything on the other side of the line was just flattened. Boats through the second or third story of a building. There were some fires going on for human remains. Smoke everywhere. The smell was overpowering. It was like getting a bucket of 15-day-old mackerel dumped on you. And you see people moving amongst the rubble looking for where their houses were. And women had died disproportionately there because it was the time of day when the wave came in when they were bathing in the water. Because the fishing nets were drying on the shore, women had been swept into them and they had found their bodies there when the water receded. The image that sticks out for me is these men walking around trying to find anything. And for me, the moment it hit me, you know, I had my mask on, you know, I was just focusing on what we were doing there. But I had taken a walk down by the water near this Hindu temple, and I remember this temple was literally had been split in half, and there were these statues of peacocks and elephants that were smashed. And I walked past it down to the water, and I saw these photographs washing ashore. And I picked up one of the photographs in the water, and it was yellowed, but I could make out the two figures in it. It was a wedding photo, and they were putting sweetened rice cakes in each other's mouth, which is the traditional wedding ceremony in that part of the world. And I just sat there on the sand looking at it. Amidst all this absolute unimaginable destruction, you would see this normal thing, like a pink child's flip-flop or that wedding picture, something that just reminded you of what the life in that place was probably like before the event happened.
You were saying to me that you had your mask on. What do you mean by that?
Well, in those types of environments, you have to be functional and you have to be operational. And every 3 feet, there's something to feel about. There's someone or something to react to. And you have to go in and, you know, be there to do business. You're not there to feel about it. You're there to affect the situation by being functional. And so when I say my mask, it's that face where you are engaging with people, but you're not engaging so much that you can't do your job.
Did you see other aid workers there at the site, other aid workers who are having trouble with this one?
I was sitting with a local staff member who had been going for, at that point, almost a couple weeks. And he had been on the board of a local orphanage there, and that orphanage was for disabled children. And it had been wiped out totally. Almost all the children there had died, had drowned. And we were sitting on this big pipe that had been ripped out of the ground. And we took a break and we were having a drink of water in the pipe. And he just matter-of-factly described what happened. And suddenly, he was sobbing. And it was this moment, it was a wonderful moment in a weird way, because I felt this amazing sense of release, and I also felt it felt good to be able to be there with him. And we both had that moment there, and then we got back up and went back to work.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Nathaniel Raymond says that 2005 was the year when disasters caught up with him as an aid worker. There were earthquakes in Pakistan, hurricanes and mudslides in Central America, the tsunami, and of course Hurricane Katrina along the U.S. Gulf Coast. Nathaniel says the relentless series of disasters left very little room for stuff in his own life.
Your primary obligation there on the ground is to respond to the situation. And so it means that you are there to serve. It's hard, though, sometimes in that environment to remember that you have to serve yourself. As my grandfather said, you're not good to anyone if you're not good to you. And we have to also remember to serve each other. And that can be really hard when everyone's feeling the burn, feeling the stress, the exhaustion, the overwhelming sense of the loss that surrounds you. And you get full. You get full of that feeling. And the best aid to get through that for the people who are the responders is to have a community and of colleagues that, you know, allows you to have that moment when you need to tag out for a second and say, oh, man.
You mentioned your grandfather. He was not well at the time when you were in Sri Lanka.
Yes, I did a month in Sri Lanka, and when I came back for my second month, he passed away. My grandfather and I were very close, and I sort of felt during that year like I had to schedule these momentous events in my life, you know. They wanted me to stay longer in Sri Lanka, and I said, I need to get home because I don't think he has much time. And within, I think it was like a week or so after I got back, he passed, and then I took a week off after that, and then I was back working on Tsunami.
And do you feel guilty when you try to carve out a little bit of personal time for yourself? I know that sounds strange, but, I mean, you've come from such suffering in Sri Lanka that even if you want that week or those 2 weeks with your grandfather, do you carry guilt for that?
Well, it's a situation where when you're in an emergency, you're surrounded by everyone giving 150,000%, you know, going to the absolute limits. And 2005 was one endless emergency. And it wasn't so much guilt as much as the sense that everyone was putting everything aside. Our other lives stood still during that year, and the priority was just dealing with all the incoming. And so the way I like to think of it, beyond talking about specifically 2005, is like being an aid worker or in any type of job where you're dealing with this immense need to have emergent response to crisis. It's like your inbox emotionally is constantly filled with urgent emails that you need to respond to. And the rest of your life is like those emails that you do need to answer, but you sort of put them aside and say, I'll get to that later. And you never get to them sometimes. And you have that backlog of things that are going on the rest of your life that you haven't processed or haven't engaged with. And for me, the hardest things is not sort of the primary trauma of seeing something that is seeing human suffering that is horrible. While that is tough, the hardest thing is dealing with the consequences of what you have not been able to be present for, what you even when you're home, what you've not been able to emotionally engage with in your personal life, and what you've lost and missed out on.
Nathaniel Raymond says he was surprised by his own reaction to Hurricane Katrina. The scale of the flood and the inadequacy of the response seemed so out of sync with his idea of America. It was also a time when he got sick, and he also began to doubt his own ability to keep doing this kind of work. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Just in the past few weeks, we've been witness to a number of significant natural disasters, cyclones, earthquakes, and the threat of flooding.
The aftermath of a massive cyclone in Burma, also known as Myanmar. The breaking news tonight, a death toll that sadly just keeps on rising. These
are images. There's death and desperation on a massive scale in central China tonight, in the wake of the worst earthquake there in many decades.
Street after street just completely decimated. Aid agencies are scrambling to send aid tonight, though it's not entirely clear the military government will accept it.
Rescue workers have still to get to the worst hit area. Over 100,000 people are still unaccounted for.
We all take some comfort in knowing that major aid agencies like Oxfam and the Red Cross and Save the Children long ago sent workers to all of these places. My conversation with Nathaniel Raymond today is an attempt to understand what happens when an aid worker gets too much of the misery. Nathaniel started doing aid work when he was 18, still in college. He was working with children orphaned by AIDS in Honduras. His group was building a wall outside a church in San Pedro Sula, where he says he learned one important lesson about aid work.
You know, we were all gung-ho college students come to make a difference, and we're, you know, struggling to carry these cinder blocks up the hill, and suddenly we see these 4, 5, 6-year-old kids carrying 2 cinder blocks running past us at high speed. And it was really satisfying because it wasn't about what we were building. You know, the best part wasn't building that dang wall. We were helping them achieve what they were trying to give themselves. And that moment, realizing it's not about me. I think when I started doing that type of work, it was about me, you know, without really admitting it. It was about my feeling a need to do something out in the world to make me feel good.
Years later, after Nathaniel joined the aid organization Oxfam and became part of the emergency response team, something else happened that cemented his desire to be an aid worker. That was Ethiopia.
I was sitting under this tree on a blanket with the oldest man in the village, who was in his early 50s. And I remember this sort of emaciated skeletal cat sitting on the blanket, and there were a group of kids sitting around who had orange hair that type of hair color is seen when children have a severe protein deficiency. And we were coming to the end of the child supplemental feeding program, and I asked the 50-year-old elder, what are you going to do when this program ends? And he looks at me, and he looks at the kids sitting on the blanket with their swollen bellies and said, well, we're going to pray. It was a punch in the gut. It was haunting to think about, after leaving that place, what happened to them.
And so what were you thinking? Was that a sense of helplessness that you were feeling at the time?
I didn't feel helpless because I was with an agency that was being very helpful, but it was an overwhelming experience because I was really seeing the human side in a way I hadn't seen that viscerally before. That was what was overwhelming for me, is that I was going to leave and it was going to be fine for me, but what about them?
And what was the effect of that on your own sense of yourself as an aid worker, that you wanted to work harder and do more? What did it do to you?
It was definitely a shot in the arm. I mean, I was compelled to do more, try harder, you know, faster, better. It was those people under that tree, those children in that place called Zawai.
In 2005, Nathaniel Raymond was still a frontline disaster worker for Oxfam. It had become routine for him to fly into places when everyone else was trying to leave them. Nathaniel says it reached a point for him when he was never really able to tune out the terrible events in the world.
When you see a disaster on TV, even if you have nothing to do with it, you immediately stop and say, all right, what do I need to do? How do I respond? It's like the fire alarm goes off at the firehouse and you're emotionally sliding down the pole. The other thing is just a hypervigilance, you know? You're constantly on alert, not being able to stand down, you know? You become emotionally used to running on an extreme amount of adrenaline, and you really have to structure it and give yourself the time that sometimes you don't have to stand down and say, all right, I'm not in an emergency right now. But that's the hardest thing. You have a hard time sleeping. You are dealing with always feeling like there's something more you can do and trying to do it. What that means is you're always on the phone, always checking your BlackBerry, even when you're back at home, and more than anything, always talking about it. And I have a lot of people in my life who are not aid workers. They don't want to hear about tsunami or Katrina or Iraq.
It's not great for relationships, right?
Oh, no. And you're bringing this herd of elephants into the room with you, and people in everyday life get to a point where, okay, great, sorry about the starving children in Africa, but could you be here now and listen to me about how I got stuck in traffic and missed my first appointment this morning? Huh. And that's really important to me, and I'm sorry about all the death and suffering, but can you hear me now?
Do you mind me asking if this has happened to you, Nathaniel? Have you lost relationships over this work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I became my work. And really just recently come to an understanding and a real degree of self-forgiveness about a relationship that was very, very important to me and that ended in 2004. And I didn't fully realize at the time how not present I was in a relationship with a person that I loved very much and that I wanted to work and it didn't. And only in hindsight did I realize the degree to which I was not standing down and really being able to be there for that other person, I lost her. I wasn't able to really see how much I was affected and how hard it was probably for her to be with me at that point.
When that relationship ended in 2004, did you just bury yourself even deeper in aid work then?
Yes. And events conspired to make it very easy. I had spent the end of 2004 in Afghanistan and Ethiopia. And at that point, I thought about working in the field full time. You know, that's the thing. When an aid worker has a bad day and you want to run away, you start looking at job postings for
a lot
civilian
of places
protection
officers.
Yeah. You start looking for job postings for civilian protection officers in you know, Burundi. And really, at that point, I was not processing the end of that relationship, and I was not processing what I'd been through, and also my father passed in 2003 from cancer. And so there was a lot of planes emotionally backed up on the runway.
Nathaniel Raymond says he had just started to realize that he was struggling with the personal toll of being an aid worker. But he was still doing the work. And then in late August 2005, another disaster struck at home.
This is a CBS News special report. The latest now in Hurricane Katrina. She is now a powerful Category 5 storm with winds up to 175 miles per hour, and she's bearing down on New Orleans, expected to make landfall.
We were at the end of the peninsula of Biloxi at a place called the Division Street Baptist Church, and it was an African-American neighborhood. And over in the predominantly white side of town, there was American Red Cross presence. There was a huge response. There was Humvees, helicopters, you know, all the king's horses and all the king's men. And you got down to Biloxi where the damage was much more severe. And people hadn't seen anybody come down there. And people were pointing up at the helicopters and saying, why aren't they going to land over here? Help did come. But to see the desperation, to see this old woman, this 90-year-old woman sitting on a pew that had been pulled out of the church because the church had flooded and was filled with mud, and she's sitting on this muddy pew with her Sunday best hat on, and she wasn't able to get her medications that she needed, to talk to her. And this is my country, I was thinking. How is this happening here? At that time, the people I was with and surrounded by who were responders, everyone was under such stress, you know, sleep deprivation, lack of proper nourishment. We were just working ourselves ragged. And I think, you know, tempers fray and flare. It was definitely clear that everyone was overly stressed.
And then you got sick later in the year.
Well, I went back to Ethiopia to prepare for a potential humanitarian crisis there, and I picked up a parasite, and it caused an infection. So by January, end of January, beginning of February, I was on the couch dealing with the consequences of that for a couple months on sick leave. And I was, on top of having a parasite, I was just so physically exhausted. I had had a year of really very few breaks, and the largest one was to bury my grandfather.
I'm just looking, you know, back through your virtual passport of 2005 with Ethiopia and Afghanistan and Sri Lanka and Katrina and return visits to all of the above and whatever came in between, and thinking to myself, why would it have been so hard for you to say, you know what, I quit. I'm taking a year off. I'm going to a beach in Australia. I'll call you.
Well, I didn't want to be anywhere else.
You wanted to keep doing the aid work.
Of course.
Which is an addiction of sort. And I know this from foreign correspondents who, you know, get it in their, under their skin. And like you, they're always checking the crawl on the CNN to see if there's some place that they ought to be or check in with the desk. But you're describing yourself in a pretty bad way at the end of 2005.
I had definitely, you know, all out of road and all out of gas. And for me, my default impulse was to keep going. And I think if I hadn't gotten sick, I probably would have. I know I would have. You know, 2005, I became at home in emergency, at home in disaster in a way I had never before felt. You know, I had normalized to it. And then at the end of that year, being at home, that was the hardest, you know? Being stuck on the couch, the focus was on me trying to take care of me.
Don't tell me, did you go back to the field earlier than the doctors told you to?
I actually went back to doing human rights investigation, communicating around ending U.S. abuses against detainees at Guantanamo and other facilities.
That's not exactly disconnecting from the same kind of work, though, is it?
No, it isn't.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Nathaniel Raymond had this sense of himself as somewhat invulnerable, able to cope in any disaster scene. He says now, in retrospect, that he was hurting himself, but it took another aid worker going for help before Nathaniel could see that.
He sort of became the mirror, you know? I looked at him and saw him having a hard time handling what we were working on, and for the first time, really, I saw myself. if he hadn't had the courage to say, hey, whoa, I'm running on fumes here, and I need some help, I probably wouldn't have sought it. And it's been one of the hardest things I've ever done. Seeking therapy, you know, I had once seen as a sign of weakness, and I feel like it's made me a better advocate for others by teaching me to be an advocate for myself.
Is it in any way similar to the kind of attitude that we see soldiers going through when they're feeling like they're not supposed to show any weakness and then they have this PTSD collapse? Are there parallels there?
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's sort of like an automatically inflating raft suddenly opening in a portalette. It gets complicated and messy really quick. And you can't wait for it to get as bad as it can get to get help.
I would imagine a lot of it has to do with self-image as well, because we're taught, and I think rightly, to admire the aid workers. These are the people that make the world a better place. So I guess what I'm wondering, Nathaniel, is does that make it harder to say, I can't do this now?
Yes, I did. The word is stigma. And I definitely played into that. There's a glamorization of the aid worker. There's, you know, this sort of pedestal that I think we can be put on by other people, by popular media. But now I just want to be, you know, whatever this means, Dick, an ordinary guy and still who does this work, but to come home fully and, you know, be Nathaniel before I'm aid worker or human rights investigator, to have, you know, something other than the career be my primary identity.
So are you in any way at peace? You know, you're in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a beautiful part of the country. Can you relax and while you're there?
Let me just say I'm getting there. Part of that is being a Red Sox fanatic. It's about really investing myself in everyday things.
I just wonder how easy that is, though. I mean, to make your priority of the morning meeting somebody at the coffee shop and spending an hour with them, or if, how do I put this? If you're still somewhere caught between what most people think of as an ordinary life and what your life used to be. I mean, is it in any way uncomfortable to be hanging out around people whose priority of the day might be how well the Red Sox did the night before?
I want nothing more than to sit at a coffee shop with the people from around the neighborhood and hear what's happening with their job, with their kids, see folks out walking their dogs, talking about the game the night before. If anything, these experiences, not to get all Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner on you, have definitely made me feel a larger capacity to appreciate just sitting there at a coffee shop where nothing happens.
Nathaniel Raymond is not doing any disaster work while he's going through his period of therapy. But I wondered what he was thinking when he first heard about the cyclone in Burma and then the earthquake in China.
I'm really lucky to have a roommate who's also in the aid field. And we're able to be, you know, good checks for each other. But I hope that, you know, in talking to you today, I can, dare I say it, you know, set an example for people to say, yes, this work is important. Yes, it deserves your all. But you have to take care of you. And you have to see it as a sign of strength to say sometimes, wow, this is a lot. This is hard.
How old are you, Nathaniel?
30.
So you started this when you were 18. That means you've basically done 12 years of this kind of work. Do you worry at all about having done some permanent damage to yourself by just pushing too hard and spending too much time bottling all this up over the years of flying around and being on the front line of disasters?
Oh, yeah. I feel like I've definitely missed out on a lot. I've wanted to be more present for my sister, for my nephew, for relationships that have mattered to me. And I feel like I have put a lot of things second. And so it's about going forward in my life in a way with balance.
So do you think you'd ever go back into the field?
Maybe. I don't think anytime soon. But I'm also beginning to realize that I don't have to do that to feel that I'm making a contribution, that feeling I have to go into the eye of the storm.
Nathaniel Raymond is the senior communications strategist with Physicians for Human Rights. He's now investigating accusations of torture against the U.S. involving detainees in places like Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. Nathaniel joined me from a studio in Boston. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We're getting a lot more particular about what we eat these days. There's a big move to consume food that's grown locally and to be more careful about different kinds of additives. Same is true for the water we drink. First, there was this big rush on to bottled water, and now the tide is back to embracing tap water. This is a debate that's all caught up with the use of those plastic bottles and the fuel that gets burned up flying bottles of water from Fiji to Frankfurt. But there's one other question that's equally important, and that is, how do we judge the quality of the water, the taste? After all, drinking water can and, well, should be enjoyed. Anne Johnson is an internationally recognized water taster. She judges water tasting competitions. And for her, the love of great drinking water began quite early. As a child, she would visit a natural mountain spring in Maryland near her grandparents' summer cottage.
Oh, what a pleasant way to spend the afternoon. The spring sat right on the side of Pennsylvania Route 326, which is a little two-lane hard surface road that runs south to the Mason-Dixon line. And it was wooded. It was very leafy and shady. Across the road from the spring was a little pull-off place where people would park, and then you would cross the road. The spring, someone had crafted a ceiling for it or a roof out of a big slab of shale. There were rocks that held the slab up, and then you would just reach down underneath the slab of stone and the water was there.
Could you see into the spring?
Oh, my. It was about 18 inches deep. And you could see every tiny little pebble on the bottom, every crevice in the pebble. It was the clearest water. There might be a few little fish in it, but it was absolutely crystal clear. Because of the little slab, the roof over it, you didn't get a reflection from the sky or anything. It was all just the pebbles on the bottom. You would see down into it, and you wouldn't even see your own reflection in it. I would love to study. I would look down and look at each little rock, and if I saw one that looked really pretty, I would reach down and pick it up, and then when I pulled it out of the water, it just looked like an ordinary stone. It needed that crystal water to bring it to life. So we would fill our jugs, and generally we would drink straight from the spring, either by cupping our hands, or I preferred the getting it right in my throat.
Putting your face right in the water.
Right, putting my face right in.
Was it cold?
Yes, so on a hot summer day, it was just a joy to stop there and cool off. You could hear the water gurgling up out of somewhere from the inside of the mountain. It was a crisp, deep, gurgling sound, beautiful, like a cello music almost. It wasn't a high pitch like your little fountains that you put on your desk, so you have a little water running in the background. Yeah. This was a real throaty sound.
So making you think of whatever caverns might be underneath that mountain.
Exactly. It felt like it was flowing up from some kind of cavern. And then it would flow into the spring, and then there was a spillway under the road, and it would flow down into a stream, fairly good-sized stream called Town Creek.
Any way of describing what the water tasted like?
Oh, my. It was like when you're a little kid and you go running out on the morning of a snowstorm and you shove fistfuls of snow into your mouth. It was so refreshing and quenching, and it had just a taste of mountain to it. I don't even know if I can put a word, if there's maybe mushrooms, you know, that sort of moldy, sweet taste, I would say. I associate it with that spring. When I eat certain kinds of mushrooms, sometimes they'll bring to mind that mountain water.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ann Johnson's joining me from a studio in Philadelphia. Ann says all of us would be better at tasting water if we saw it as something more than a mere thirst quencher. Well, she should know. As a judge at the Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting Competition held earlier this year, Ann had to drink a lot of water.
That's the beauty of it, or the craziness of it, is that in the course of one day, we taste between 60 and 80 individual glasses of water, each from a different source. And they go in flights. The first one is municipal water. The second one is what they call the purified water, where they take a water from a source and they try to take every last everything out of it, almost like a distilled water.
Right.
So there's your challenge, because they all taste alike. They're supposed to taste alike. They're supposed to not taste like anything. You know, they do.
These are like some of the bottled waters that we would buy today, the purified ones?
Right. Anything that says purified.
Okay.
And then the third would be your mountain spring waters. And then the fourth, which is my favorite, the last one, is the sparkling water.
So there's a number of judges like yourself. How is it set up? I mean, do they pour it into a paper cup, or how do they get you from one to the next to the next to the next?
They seat us on a dais, and they put a white paper tablecloth with circles on it, and each circle has a number in it. And then they bring out hand-polished wine glasses. I wouldn't want the job of hand-polishing wine glasses for a dozen water judges who are each going to drink 24 glasses. Someone has to hand-polish all these,
right,
and their wine glasses. And then they put one at each number. And then your scorecard, you score number one, number two, down the line that way. And they have water bearers who bring the water in carafes. So they have to know which number glass they're filling.
And is it all very hushed, like a sort of auction hall for Sotheby's or something like that? Or is it a little raucous and silly?
The mood is upbeat. I wouldn't say it's silly, but it's a cheerful thing. It's a sort of a celebration of water.
So a county fair type atmosphere then. Would that be a good
No, I wouldn't. The county fair, you get the feeling of a 4-H kind of everybody's laughing.
And everybody gets a ribbon.
Yeah. This is more sedate than that. And some of the judges are very serious, and some of them are more easygoing about it. It's hard to categorize it either as county fair or as wine tasting, because it certainly falls right dead center in the middle of those two extremes.
So tell me what you're judging, Ann. Tell me what the things that you're looking for in a glass of water would be. I mean, do you pick up the glass and swirl it around and sniff it in the way that a wine taster, or you do?
Absolutely. First thing you look for is clarity. Of course, all water is clear. So I've never judged a water that looked milky or full of sediment. Because
I don't think I'd drink that one.
No, I would pass that one by, thank you. But you do look at the clarity, and you definitely smell it, and waters do have an aroma. Once again, if you're thinking about it, you can smell the difference in water. And what you look for is a smell of maybe mold or minerals or chlorine, or there's a little bit of salt in some of them. And after that, then you taste them. And there are several steps to the tasting. You want to see how it feels in your mouth. You want to see if there's any particular flavor that jumps out.
Can I put you to work now, Ann? I mean, I know that you've got a glass of water in the studio there with you. I'm assuming it's municipal water. Is the paper cup okay? Can you work with that?
Sure. This must be Philadelphia water. Nice and clear. Looks like it's got bubbles in it, so I would say it's pretty well aerated. But see, now I'm smelling it and I'm getting paper cup. That's the problem. I'm not getting my, you know, where's my wine glass that's been hand polished?
I let you down.
Okay, I had my taste and my swallow. I would say that Philadelphia's water is good on the swallow, because now, different from wine tasting, with wine tasting you're not supposed to swallow, but water tasting, the swallow and the quench factor is very important.
Huh.
Which, you know, after 80-some sips of water over 6 hours, you know, you've got judges who are pretty bloated.
Excusing themselves often.
Yes. I'll be right back. But I would mark it down for a kind of a brackish mineral taste. But I don't taste chlorine, which is, for a major municipality like this, that's pretty amazing.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ann Johnson works as a judge at water tasting competitions. And as Ann was saying, at the Berkeley Springs event, she had to sip 80 different kinds of water, bottled, tap, sparkling. So how do they make the distinctions? Do they use the same kind of language that the wine world embraces? Saucy, but not domineering. Anne says adjectives are never in short supply.
They give you a set of adjectives that you can attach, or you can make up your own. Someone wrote wet Band-Aid next to one of the entrants because they said it tastes like the water that you would squeeze out of a wet Band-Aid.
I'm assuming that's not a flattering description.
Yeah, that didn't sound too appetizing. But I tend to stick to the main ones being musty, stale, brackish or salty, minerals, chlorine, just so that if I have to go back and compare one to another, I have a benchmark that is the same all through. There was one that we had as in a practice round that was so bad that I said it tastes like it bubbled up from some oasis where the camels had already, you know, had their way with it.
Was it put there to judge the judges, I wonder?
It was. It was actually particularly chosen because it tasted bad. And I think they wanted to see which ones of us could pick out the worst.
So had they just put some mud water in, or was this real water that someone would buy?
This was actually a high-end water, but the bottler was looking for a new source.
Where was it from? Do you remember?
It turned out that the water itself came from Mount Ararat, which, you know, my geography isn't
it's
great.
Turkey, but yeah.
Yeah, Turkey, you know, the Noah's Ark mountain. So
you've got water from all over the world in this competition.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Where else does it come from?
One country that has sent many, many entries and has done very well is Bosnia. Before the era of the Iron Curtain, Bosnia was kind of a spa area. It was well known for its mineral springs, and they still bottle a lot of water there, and they have won a lot of gold medals from this competition. I have participated in the water tasting twice, and on both occasions I was drawn immediately to these Bosnian sparkling waters. This is a natural sparkling water like Perrier,
yeah.
And it's just terrific. It just absolutely explodes in your mouth. If you like effervescence, if you like your siphon and your soda water, this had just a crackle to it that I've never been able to find. And in the glass, it looked still. It didn't even have much what we call bead, which mm-hmm. is the little bubbles coming up. They call that bead. And it just sort of sat there still. And then when you tasted it, it just kaboom in your mouth. They did have a few bottles left over, and I brought them home, and my daughter and I, we had a match to see who could grab them first and drink them.
Do you buy bottled water as a matter of course because you're such a connoisseur?
In all honesty, I don't buy a lot of bottled water. Most of the really good ones are only locally available where they come from.
Yeah.
For instance, Canada sends lots of water down, and you can't get that water here, so there's no point in going out and hunting for those bottles of water in stores.
Yeah.
And therefore, if I'm thirsty and I happen to be out and there's a Coke machine, I'll just, water connoisseurs sort of look down their noses at the big ones, the Aquafina and the Dasani. And I don't feel that way at all. I feel like that's as environmentally friendly as bottled water can be.
Yeah, I wondered if part of your choosing not to buy bottled water was an environmental thing, because, of course, there's been so much recently about the amount of plastic in the bottles and, you know, how tap water can be just as good and so on and so forth. Where do you come down on that?
I've examined that from all sides, and there are issues everywhere you look. It takes 3 liters of water to make 1 liter of bottled water. So it's
Why is
kind
that?
Of a wasteful. the process of creating the bottles, the process of running the plant.
Oh, and washing the bottles and all that
right.
stuff. I understand. Okay.
At the same time, anything that comes out of your tap, if you have municipal water, has to be rigorously tested. So I have no problem with turning on my tap if I'm thirsty and getting a glass of water from there. I don't buy bottled water and stock my refrigerator with it. At the same time, our pipes that bring us our municipal water are old. We have these water main breaks all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the pipes are old. They are always trying to find the cheapest way to fix. So you really can't be 100% comfortable with the tap water.
So
everywhere.
You're a little conflicted on this
one. Yes, because I've had to look at it from every angle.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ann Johnson has trained herself to taste water as a beverage, something more than just a thirst quencher. So I had to ask her if that makes her friends nervous, wondering what kind of water to serve when they have Ann over for dinner.
No, I can't distinguish a Pinot from a Chardonnay, so any nervousness they would feel over their water can be compensated by just serving me the cheapest wine they can find.
So let me close out your judging in the competition. There must come a time when you know, you're into the sort of, I don't know, 83rd glass of water, and you're going, yeah, just the same as the last one. It's got to be a kind of time when you just can't make those distinctions anymore.
I actually had that happen to me this year with the spring water, of all things. It just seemed like every glass of spring water I drank tasted exactly like the last one, and I was wondering if it was me. It can get baffling, and it can be daunting the way they put all the glasses out. You might have 24 glasses in front of you, each with its inch or 2 inches of water, and if you just look at it all, you go, oh, I can't do this. I just can't do this.
I wonder, Anne, if you've ever gone back to that Appalachian spring to sort of reset your palate, to go back and see if the water that you drew from that spring as a little girl was as good as you remember it.
Well, this is the tragedy. Because the spring lies right by the road, it has been polluted and is no longer deemed safe to drink. I haven't been back there. It's still there. Really, if I was to go back to the Black Valley Spring, I would drink from it. I'm not sure I'd want it as my sole source of water, but there's stuff all around us. You just have to take your chances.
Ann Johnson is a professional water taster. She wrote an essay about her experience that was first published in the online magazine SmartSet.com, and we have a link to that on our website at thestory.org. Plus, if you have a story or an unusual talent or a magnificent obsession, you can get a hold of me through our website at thestory.org, or just leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. Coming up tomorrow in The Story, Joyce Grangent started using cocaine in college, and later on that led to a serious addiction. She remembers battling the urge for crack even while she was in the elevator of a rehab center.
This young man opened up his hand, and he had 30, 40 bags of crack cocaine, and he like, come on, you want to go with me and get high? And I was just fixated on the bags in his hand. And, you know, when I looked at it, it was like, boy. But I jumped off the elevator. Well, I got off at my floor, and I went to my room, and I was pacing back and forth. And then I'm like, damn, I should have at least asked what room he was in. I don't even know who it is.
Joyce Grangent talks about the way that crack ruined her life and how she found her way back. That's The Story tomorrow. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.